Chapter 24 Party in the City. Mitchell made me scrape off the nail polish that Mary Catherine had painted on my toes a few days before I had been captured. There wasn't much left, but he didn't want to take any chances. While I scraped the last of the blue polish off, he and Barzee worked together to sew veils that could be buttoned onto the sides of our headdresses. The veils were made of thick, white material and reached from just below our eyes to halfway down our necks, leaving very little of our faces exposed. After they were finished, Mitchell made me put the veil on so he could inspect me. Nodding in approval, he turned and started down the hill. We made our way down the side of the mountain until we got to the trail. Then he turned west and started hiking down the canyon. Mitchell led the way, his two green sacks tied across his back. I followed immediately behind him. Barzee walked right behind me. My captors were never more than a few feet away, so close that I could smell them, so close that I could always hear them breathing, so close that even if I had gathered up the courage, I could not have run away. It was hot, the sun beating through the branches on the trees. I felt like I was suffocating, the thick veil making it very hard to breathe. The heavy robe swished around my feet, kicking up dust that stuck to my clothes. The farther down we hiked, the clearer the trail became. Crossing over two outcroppings of fractured rocks, Mitchell suddenly turned to the right. "Stay," he commanded. Climbing to the top of the dirt embankment, he pushed a couple branches out of the way, revealing the shoe tree. Hidden in a hole in the tree was a pair of sandals for him and a pair for Barzee. Prophets didn't wander around in hiking boots, don't you know? They had to wear sandals to match their robes. He and Barzee put on their prophet shoes, then he gave me Barzee's hiking boots and commanded me to put them on. Hiding his boots in the hollow tree, he covered the opening with the rotten sticks, and we headed down again. The canyon began to open up, and the trail became well used and clear. Soon it intersected with the main path that ran along the foothills at the bottom of the canyon. This was Dry Creek, a very popular jogging and biking trail. We turned left and kept on walking. Parts of Salt Lake City came into view. My heart jumped in my throat. I was less than a mile from my home. Around a bend in the trail, a jogger emerged, running right toward me. "Look at me!" I was screaming in my mind. "Look at me! Don't you recognize me? Don't you know who I am?" Of course he didn't. He could only see my eyes. To him, we were just a couple of odd ducks dressed in old gray robes and veils. Not the kind of thing one expected to see on the mountain trail, but the scene didn't scream kidnapping by any means. The jogger drew closer. I stared at him, never taking my eyes off his face. "Look at me," I kept praying in my mind. "Think about what you're seeing. How many times have you seen this? Two women walking on a trail in Salt Lake City, their faces covered with veils. Look at me. Think about this. Look into my eyes." The jogger passed within a few feet of me, then moved on, his attention always focused on the trail. I felt myself deflate, the hope seeping out of my body. A biker then emerged a little farther down the trail. "Look at me," I screamed in my mind again. But he didn't. He kept his head down. The only time he even seemed to notice me was when he glanced up to maneuver his bike around us as he passed. He was so close, I could have touched him as he rode by. But of course, he didn't recognize me. I was nothing but a walking sheet and two eyes above a veil. Up till that point, I'd had this fantasy that someone was going to see me and immediately scream out my name. Someone was going to rescue me. A cop was going to recognize me and come over and arrest Mitchell without me even saying anything. But I realized now that wasn't going to happen. No one was going to recognize me. No one was going to stop and talk to me. I might as well have been chained up back at the camp as walking around hidden underneath the veil. As I looked at my captors, it hit me. Our appearance, the robes, Mitchell's wild beard, the veils invited distance and mistrust. It demanded that we be given a wide berth. Everything about us begged to be ignored. A little less than half a mile later, the trail broke into the open. The University of Utah campus lay before us. The hospitals and medical center were on our left. Downtown Salt Lake City was on our right. The Jewish center was in front of us. We hiked through the center's parking lot toward the bus stop, where we caught the first bus and rode it downtown to 400 South. Climbing off the bus, I felt ridiculous. People acted like we were radioactive, staying as far away from us as possible. I shook with frustration. I was back in the city. This was my home. Didn't anyone recognize me? Didn't anyone remember all the posters with my face? Mitchell stopped and leaned toward me as the bus pulled away. "I will kill you," he sneered as he stared into my eyes. "Remember that, Esther. I will kill your entire family. Your mom, your dad, your brothers and your little sister. I will kill them all, slicing them with my knife. I will kill them if you try to get away." Barzi moved so she could whisper in my ear. "He will do it," she hissed. "You can't stop him. He is Emmanuel." They waited for me to acknowledge them. Mitchell leaned forward once again. "I will chain you up forever if you don't do everything I say." I slowly nodded. The threat was very clear. Mitchell stared at me, trying to decide if he believed me. Satisfied, he seemed to smile. "All right, then," he said. "The first thing we need to do is get some beer." He led us to a small grocery store. Walking in, he seemed to know exactly where to go. He walked up and down the aisles, pausing to shove food into his bags, crackers, blocks of cheese, cans of tuna, cookies and beef jerky. Then he went to the beer cooler and shoved in a couple six-packs of Heineken. His sacks were almost full. I was amazed at how brazen he was about it. My heart was racing. I had never shoplifted before. But clearly, Mitchell was not afraid. Grabbing a head of lettuce and a bottle of pickles, he walked up to the checkout counter. Barzi and I followed, never saying anything. The young man behind the counter seemed to recognize Mitchell. He was a sketchy-looking character. Dyed black and purple hair, white skin, thin as a skeleton. He glanced at the stuffed bags. If he knew that Mitchell had just shoved a bunch of food into his sacks, and he had to have known, he didn't say anything. In fact, he didn't even run the bottle of pickles across the scanner. The head of lettuce was the only thing he ran up. So this is how it works, I thought. Later, he would be Mitchell's source of marijuana. Another step in my journey to descend below all things. But for now, he was just a generous cashier who was willing to let Mitchell shove a lot of food into his bags. He and Mitchell exchanged some talk about a party that was going on that night, and then we left. Mitchell quickly led us toward a public restroom a block or so down the street. When we got there, he went in to make sure it was deserted, then pulled me inside. The restroom was dark and depressing, with black walls and a dark green ceiling. It smelled of urine and rotting garbage. The perfect place to get me drunk. He forced me to drink a couple of beers. How can anyone drink that stuff for pleasure? I remember thinking as I forced the beer down, I almost gagged, coming very close to throwing up. With a couple of beers inside us, it was time to get the real party going. Mitchell led us to the nearest liquor store. He went in while Barzi and I waited on the sidewalk. We must have looked ridiculous. Nothing going on here, you know, just the prophet's women hanging outside the liquor store while he goes in to get some rum. I screamed inside my mind at everyone who passed. Look at me! Look at my eyes! Don't any of you recognize me? But everyone was more than happy to ignore us and walk by. Still, part of me was elated at being in the city. I was away from the camp. I was out in public. Anything was better than being cabled to trees. Mitchell came out with his purchases stuffed in a bag. "We're heading down to Liberty Park," he said. "Going to drink a little rum and coke." We walked down to the park where Mitchell began to survey his surroundings, looking for anyone he might know. While he checked things out, I sat on a nearby swing and started swaying gently back and forth. Mitchell moved closer to me. Barzy followed, moving to my other side. So there I swung, Barzy on one side and Mitchell on the other. I looked around at the children who were playing all around me. "You are so lucky," I thought. A few of them seemed to glance at me. All of them were afraid. Mitchell didn't like being around the other people. "Follow me," he said. Walking toward the picnic tables, we crossed a small water park with spouting geysers of water coming out of the ground. I took off my shoes and started walking barefoot through the spouts of water, the cool spray upon my feet. "I am alive, but I am not living," I remember thinking as I walked. "I am the living dead. I'm nothing but a shell." I closed my eyes and imagined the water pulling me away, helping me to run away from Mitchell and Barzy forever. I felt the water running over my toes as it moved toward the drains. For a moment, I imagined it sucking the last of my spirit with it, washing my soul away. I wanted desperately to escape, to melt away with the rushing water, never to be seen again. I was a shell already. Why not let my spirit go? Why not let my soul escape into nothingness that lay wherever the water went? Why not let my soul depart and leave my empty body to go through the motions of living in this world? Mitchell and Barzy stood at the edge of the water park and watched me. I lifted my face toward the sky, wishing I could feel the sun upon my cheeks. I drifted back in time. I was with my family. I felt their love around me. I felt the peace of being in my home. I felt the comfort of an earlier day and time, before Mitchell, before the pain, before everything that had left my empty body standing in the middle of the water park. Thinking of my family, I resolved again, whatever it takes to survive this, whatever it takes to live. Mitchell pulled me back to this world. "Esther," he called impatiently, "come on over here." I immediately followed. He led us toward the nearest picnic table. A family that was close by quickly gathered up their things and moved on. Mitchell took out the rum and coke and 3 plastic red cups, pouring us all a drink. And that's how we spent the afternoon. Pretty soon, I thought I was going to be sick, and Mitchell finally quit pouring me any more. But he and Barzy kept on drinking, finishing the bottle off. When the coke and rum was gone, it was time to move on. We walked into the Hard Rock Cafe to use the lavatory. Because it was a public bathroom and people were all around, Mitchell couldn't follow me into the women's room. But Barzy could, and she always stayed very close. Slipping into a stall, I had an idea. Part of my veil had been attached with a safety pin. Quickly, I unsnapped it and started scratching the word "help" into the paint on the door of my stall. My foolish hope was that someone would use the stall immediately after me, see the cry for help, realize it was me, and call the police. It didn't work out. Mitchell decided it was time to head back to our camp. We started making our way east toward the trails. Getting closer to the university, he remembered that Daniel, the generous grocery clerk, had told him about a party that was going on that night. Realizing we were close to the location of the party, he decided we would go. By now, I was exhausted. It was late and already growing dark. I hadn't eaten much of anything all day, and the rum was making me feel very drowsy and run down. I could tell that Barzy didn't want to go to the party either, but she didn't object. She knew she was standing on thin ice, and she was careful not to mess up Mitchell's fun. We found the party house. It was a small brick and stucco structure in an old part of the city, surrounded by huge trees and other small homes set back from the road. By then it was dark, but the house was well lit, and there were lots of people. I mean, lots of people. Lots of music, lots of red plastic solo cups, lots of beer. We walked into the house. It was literally body to body. There were people everywhere. It was heat and smoke and sweat. Laughter and shouting, drinking, smoking, kissing, and lots of other things I had never imagined before. Things I couldn't have imagined. They were beyond my universe. It terrified me to see the underbelly of such a world. Then I had the most horrifying thought of all. Mitchell loved to be the big man, the man with all the answers and the power. What if he started passing me around? What if he shared me with the other men in the room, maybe even the other women? I pressed against the wall, trying to make myself invisible, and for the first time, I was grateful to have my face covered with the veil. Ever anxious to be the center of attention, Mitchell moved to the middle of the room and started preaching. Yes, he was a prophet. He told the people who were close enough to hear, but even God ate and drank among the sinners, and he was happy to be among the lesser people of the world. Mitchell preached. I looked over to see the young man from the grocery store standing next to me. I reached up to lift my veil a little higher on my face. The young man studied me, then moved a little closer. You have beautiful eyes, he said. I wanted to faint. No one had ever said anything like that to me before. I realized that he was, I couldn't think of the phrase, coming on to me. I was shocked. For a moment, I wondered if he would have said what he did if he knew that I was only 14 years old. Judging from some of the things that were going on around me, I don't think he would have cared. I backed away from him. Or at least, I tried. But I was already pushed against the wall. He leaned into me again and started to say something when Mitchell suddenly appeared at my side, anxious to keep me under his control. A glass jar full of a thick, yellowish-white fluid was being passed around the room. Mitchell turned his eyes fixed upon the glass container. Absinthe, he said in glee. The word didn't mean anything to me, but it sure did to Mitchell. He pushed people aside to get in line for the drink. Grabbing the jar, he brought it to me. You've got to drink some of this, he demanded. It looked horrible, like rotten, I don't know, like a mix of spoiled milk and orange juice. It's crushed from a special root, he explained, pointing toward the kitchen where they were apparently crushing more. You've got to taste it. It causes hallucinations. I didn't even want to smell it, let alone put it to my lips. He pushed the jar toward my mouth, passing it under my veil. The rim of the jar touched my lips. It was the most horrible thing I had ever tasted. Rancid as acid, musky as rotten leaves. It made my lips burn and my throat tighten up. Mitchell pulled the jar back and took a long drink. He definitely didn't want to share. I watched his Adam's apple bob as he swallowed the bitter liquid down. He drank much more than his share before passing it on, then stepped back to move among the crowd again. A couple of girls came up to talk to me. They seemed to be concerned. Hey, how are you? One of them asked. But before I could answer, Mitchell was back at my side, pulling me to keep me close. He went back to preaching about God and how he'd sent his prophet out among the sinners. A young woman with a sword tattoo in the middle of her chest seemed to tire of his preaching. Are you Jesus? She demanded sarcastically. No, but I'm his prophet. She studied his robe and slippers, casting a suspicious eye on me. Am I a sinner then? She swept her arm around the room. Are all of us sinners? I don't like being called a sinner. None of us do. A few other people started gathering around. Mitchell, ever anxious for attention, began to preach even louder. An argument quickly developed until another woman stepped up and pulled him by the arm. She seemed to be in charge, and she moved him toward the door. You are not welcome here, she shouted, pushing him out of the house. Go and do your preaching somewhere else. You are my guardian angel, Mitchell told her again and again. You have saved me. You have delivered me from danger. You have saved the prophet of the Lord. She didn't seem to be impressed. She shoved him off the porch. We stood in the front yard for a moment. It seemed that Mitchell was thinking of the next thing that we could do. Barzee was worn out and getting angry. We're going back to camp, she said. Yes, yes. Back to camp, I prayed. I was exhausted to the point of feeling sick. I had been walking and drinking all day, and it was very late now. I didn't know what time it was, but it was well past midnight, and I was so tired that I could hardly walk. We're going back to camp, Barzee said again. Mitchell only nodded at her blankly. I don't know if he was seeing leprechauns or unicorns, but it was obvious that he was not in this world. We started walking, dragging our feet along. We got as far as Greek Row, where most of the fraternities and sororities are located on the U of U campus, when Mitchell suddenly sat down and said that we had to rest a while. He was so drunk and out of it, he couldn't go on. Barzee was furious. For hours she had been trying to get him to go back to camp. She didn't want to go to the party. She didn't want to stay there so long. She didn't want to listen to him preaching or watch him guzzle whatever concoction was in the jar. Now it was approaching morning, and he wanted to lie down on the side of the road and take a nap. She waited for as long as she could stand it, then stood up and yelled at him, Emmanuel, you are not acting as the Lord's servant. You're just noticing that? I thought sarcastically. You are not acting like a prophet of God. Mitchell didn't move. Get up, Barzee started screaming. Get up or I'm taking Esther with me and leaving you. Mitchell looked at her with a drunken and dazed expression. Long seconds passed. He didn't move. Barzee had had enough. Esther and I are leaving, she announced. She grabbed me by the arm. Get up, you're coming with me. I struggled to my feet. She held my hand and started to pull me back up toward the mountains. We stumbled along, both of us exhausted. Too much walking, no food, too many parties, and too much alcohol. We made it to the main path, stumbling in the moonlight, then walked a half a mile or so before turning up the narrow trail that led to our camp. I noticed that it was getting lighter now. Daybreak was not far away. I stumbled on, following Barzee in a stupor, too tired to think about anything but putting one foot in front of the other. Past both of the rock outcroppings, past the spot where the stream crossed the trail, the eastern sky grew lighter, bringing on the gray light of dawn. We hiked a mile or so farther, then turned and made our way straight up the side of the mountain. There was no trail, and we had to cut our way through the brush and trees, the dry leaves crunching under our feet. It was fully light by now. The mountainside grew steeper, and I didn't know if I had the strength to climb any longer. Just when I thought I couldn't go on, we broke out of the trees. An open meadow lay before us. I immediately recognized that we were at one of the lower camps. Barzee marched over to where they had hidden their supplies, pulling me along. While she sorted through their gear, I fell in exhaustion on the ground, closed my eyes, and instantly fell asleep. Barzee kicked my feet. Help me! She demanded. Together we set up the small purple tent. The instant we were finished, I crawled inside and passed out from exhaustion. I woke up to the sound of voices and a suffocating heat. Late morning sun seeped through the tent, turning it into a greenhouse. It must have been 100 degrees inside. I crawled out of the tent, stumbling with thirst. Mitchell and Barzee were talking in the center of the camp. I didn't know it yet, but a decision had been made. The following day, we hiked up to our campsite, gathered up most of the essential gear, and took it down to the lower camp. Though we would hike up to the springhead almost every day for water, from that day until we moved to California, we stayed at the lower camp. I was never cabled to the trees again. There was no longer any need. I had reached the point where I was being held captive by Mitchell's words. Chapter 25. Too scared to speak. A couple of days passed after our first trip down into the city. We spent the first day recovering, then a day or two moving all of our gear down from the upper camp and setting things up in the new campsite. The new camp was much lower on the mountain. I guess that it was maybe halfway between the city and the high camp, and it had a different feel. The trees were closer together, and sometimes you could smell the salt that blew in from the lake. At night, you could see the city lights glow in the western sky, and the wind was not quite as strong as it was up near the peaks. For the first day or two in the lower camp, Mitchell seemed to be on edge, constantly looking down the canyon, his head cocked to listen against the wind, but after a while he began to relax. "The Lord has told me something," he announced to us one morning. I immediately turned to him, my chest growing tight. I felt the adrenaline shoot through my body and my hands began to shake. Whenever Mitchell had an announcement, it turned out to be sickening news, and I braced myself for another catastrophe. He took his time, letting the tension build. It was always the same. Whenever the prophet had received a revelation, it took a little effort to get it out. I was sitting on the ground in the lower camp. We were sitting in a circle on the gray tarp laid outside the tent door. It was mid-morning, and the sun was just beginning to warm where we sat in the trees. I didn't have the cable around my ankle, and I was grateful for that. But that wasn't enough to make me happy. I was still welded to Mitchell. I was anything but free. His words were stronger to me than any chains or cables ever could be. We waited for him to speak. I studied his face. His hair had much more gray in it. It was also growing thinner. So was his face. I turned to Barzee. Same thing. Strands of gray hair. Blotchy patches on her face. It was as if both of them were growing older right before my eyes. 30 years. I can outlive them. It was such a depressing thought. Then I felt a shiver of warmth and heard a voice inside my head. No, it won't be that long. The feeling took me completely by surprise, and the shiver definitely wasn't from something cold, but something warm. It seemed to seep into my soul, like warm water filling all of the emptiness that I had felt inside. I felt the power of my Heavenly Father near me. I almost started crying with relief. It won't be 30 years. Stay strong. I haven't left you. I closed my eyes, thinking back on the time I had stood in the middle of the water park and wished that my soul could slip away. No, that's not the answer. I will provide a way. I kept my eyes closed and took a deep breath. Turning back to Mitchell, I waited for his announcement with new resolve. "The Lord has veiled the whole of the city's eyes," he finally said. "He wants us to go among the people now. We are free to walk among them. We will rely on the Lord to keep us safe. We will rely on the Lord to take care of us and shield us from danger while he tests our faith." If Barzee had been told about the decision, she didn't show it. In fact, she seemed to be a little surprised. I stared at him. So, he was going to allow me to go into the city all the time now? I almost shrugged. Stay here, go into the city. Either way, I couldn't run. I suppose I was a little happy not to have to stay in the camp all the time. It would relieve a little of the boredom. But I hated the thought of having to walk everywhere we went. I hated the thought of going down and getting drunk every day, or going to horrendous parties and dragging home as the sun was coming up. Mitchell watched me carefully. "All right, then," he said. "We are going down into the city. But you understand the rules, don't you, Esther? I don't have to review them for you, do I? I don't have to talk about your life or the life of your family. You're going to be a good wife, aren't you, Esther?" I looked at him with blank eyes, but nodded silently. "Stay strong. I haven't left you," seemed to roll around in my head. We started making regular trips down into Salt Lake. Sometimes we'd go every day. Sometimes a couple days would pass. Every trip was pretty much the same. Drinking, plundering, walking down to either Liberty Park or the Artesian Well to eat whatever we had stolen, and then hiking back to the lower camp again. Every trip pretty much took all day. We were always on foot, and even from the lower camp it was a long hike. Occasionally, we would ride the bus once we got into the city, but we almost always walked, which meant we were walking many miles. Sometimes Mitchell would preach enough to get a little money. Almost all of it was spent on alcohol and dope. But there was a couple times that he let us go out to eat. Once at a Chuck-O-Rama, once at the Super Salad, and once at a hamburger and ice cream place called the Iceberg Drive-In. I loved being able to go in and eat some real food. Something warm, something that didn't come out of a cardboard box or a tin can. It was more wonderful than I can explain. But I hated the way that people looked at us. Mitchell in his wild beard and dirty robe. Barzi and me with our white head coverings that entirely hid our hair. Our eyes peering above the veils. Nothing but our hands exposed. Everyone thought that we were crazy, and they treated us that way. How could you blame them? This was Utah, not Afghanistan. Once or twice, someone would come up and ask what religion we belonged to. Mitchell always did the talking. A few of these people would look at me much longer than they looked at Mitchell or Barzi. When they did, I would stare back into their eyes, trying to communicate with them. Yes, you are right. I am Elizabeth Smart. But that is as far as it would ever go. Stares, brief conversations, nothing more. Near the end of August, Mitchell started to talk about what we would do for the coming winter. He had started to build a dugout, but it was far from being ready, and he didn't work on it any longer. Too much plundering, raping, and drinking to do. We knew we couldn't stay on the mountain. We didn't have any supplies. We didn't live day to day. We lived meal to meal. There was no way we could survive the winter in the unfinished dugout. No way we could hike up and down the trail every day for food. We didn't have any warm clothes, no winter supplies, no source of heat besides a fire. Utah winters were always brutal, with lots of snow and constant freezing temperatures, especially in the mountains. Knowing we'd have to move before winter set in, Mitchell started talking about the options. He talked about renting an apartment. Wasn't going to happen. No money. And he wasn't going to get a job. He talked about going back to stay with a family whom they'd lived with before. One of his friends who had taught him about the medical use of herbs, but quickly realized that wasn't going to work. Even if his friends didn't recognize me, how was he going to explain a 14-year-old wife? So he kept working on the problem. "I thought you said the Lord would provide," I asked him as he debated all his options. "Oh, he will," Mitchell shot back. "But he expects me to do everything I can to protect myself." Which was kind of interesting. Mitchell relied completely on the Lord for the things we needed to survive. Well, the Lord, and a little luck, and a lot of begging, and a lot of stealing. But when it came to any chance of getting arrested or having me taken from him, he wasn't quite as ready to rely upon the Lord, which left very few options. Cold winter, lots of snow, no food, nowhere to live. What was the answer? To go somewhere warm, of course. Before we could decide where to go, we needed to do a little research. We needed to do some reading and study some maps. The next day we headed down from the lower camp and went straight to the Salt Lake City Public Library. Walking through the front doors, I stopped to look around. It was the first time that I had ever been there. and I didn't know where to go. Mitchell seemed to hesitate as well. I glanced toward the ladies at the checkout counter. They tried not to stare, but it was difficult, and it took them a few seconds before they finally turned away. A man was sitting at the table near the entrance. He stared at us as well. He looked to be in his mid-30s, just a normal-looking guy. Looking at me, he pulled out his cell phone and walked out of the library to make a call. I don't know if he was the one who called the police, but I have always thought he was. Mitchell led us up the stairway to the second floor. He got us settled at a table that was out of the way, then went to work gathering up a series of maps and books for us to study. The library wasn't busy, and it was very quiet. A few people climbed up and down the stairs. A young Asian girl, probably a university student, was the only other person in the map section, and she paid us no attention once she got past her initial shock at our appearance. Mitchell spread out a large map of California. Holding the corners, he studied it, moving his finger down the coastline, passing over one city and then another. He talked about each city as he moved his finger south. San Francisco, Sacramento, L.A., San Diego. He spouted a bunch of facts about each of the cities, but I don't know if he really knew what he was talking about. He studied the map a few more minutes, then tapped on San Diego. "Here," he announced, "this will be our new home." I looked up to see a man approaching us. He was dressed in casual clothes, and I thought he was a visitor to the library who was coming to ask a question. "Do you know where the bathroom is?" I expected him to ask. But he didn't. Drawing closer, he pulled out a badge. "I am a homicide detective. I have a few questions for you," he said to Mitchell. I thought my heart was going to explode. I turned to him and stared. I started shaking. My head was spinning. I was dizzy with hope and anticipation and gut-wrenching fear. Mitchell's words started screaming in my head. "I will kill you and your family. I will cut them with my knife." His threats were the only thing that I could think about, the only thing inside my head. The officer glanced at me, but kept most of his attention on Mitchell. "We have received a few phone calls suggesting this girl might be someone who has disappeared. If you could just allow me to remove the veil and see her face, then we can clear this up. That way, if we get any other calls, we can tell them we have already checked you out." I felt a surge of joy so powerful, I thought that I would cry. I wanted to stand up and run toward the officer. I wanted to jump into his arms. I wanted to rip my veil off and cry upon his shoulders. But I couldn't. I couldn't. But it didn't matter anyway. He was here. He was strong. He knew what he was doing. He was going to save me now. I kept my eyes upon the officer. "This is it," I thought. "Nobody is going to hurt me. No one is going to hurt my family. I didn't say anything. I didn't do anything. I've been quiet. I've been good. Mitchell has no reason to blame me. It's over. It's over. I'm going home." Then I felt a hand clamp down on my leg, the dirty nails digging into my thigh. It felt as cold and hard and powerful as a metal vise. Feeling Barzee's hand upon my leg made my heart stop. It was like I was instantly transported back in time. Every moment, every detail of the past 10 weeks flooded into my mind. The night that I had been kidnapped, walking up the mountain, the first time that Mitchell raped me, being chained up, sitting on the bucket and crying until Mitchell finally screamed at me to stop, hearing my uncle's voice calling my name, the helicopter above the trees, ice-cold water being dumped on my head, Mitchell going down to kidnap my cousin, the taste of beer, the fog of alcohol, the threats against my family or anyone who tried to rescue me, days of waiting, days of praying, months of indoctrination, being told that I came from a wicked and sinful world, being told my family was paving their own paths to hell, being told that I should consider myself lucky that I had been chosen to be his wife. But above all else, I knew the hard grip was Barzee's way of telling me, it doesn't matter what you say or don't say. It doesn't matter what you do or don't do. If we are captured, we will kill you. We will get you in the end. Another painful scene unfolded in my head. I flashed back to the first time that I'd met her, the image playing in slow motion in my mind, the silver morning sky, the mountain air heavy with the smell of pine, my red pajamas hanging at my feet, my heart beating like a hummingbird's. Barzee knew that her husband was about to rape me, and yet she didn't care. She had walked up and put her arms around me, her hot breath against my ear. She had held me like a daughter. She knew that I was not a young woman. She knew that I was just a child. But still, she held me tight. And it was not an embrace of warmth or kindness. It was a wrap of power, its only purpose to instill a sense of dominance. Reliving these emotions, I was overcome with fear. I will kill you. I will kill your family. The words rolled around and around inside my head. So I lowered my eyes and stared at the table, never daring to look up at the officer again. Every particle of my being was on edge. Could the officer protect me from my captors? Could he keep my family safe? I didn't know. I really didn't. He was just one guy against an evil man who seemed to have more power of deception than any other man in the world. All I'm asking is that you let me see her face, the homicide officer was saying. This is my daughter, Mitchell answered. I can't allow you to do that. It is strictly forbidden by our religion. It would be against everything that we believe in. The officer was silent as he thought. I felt his eyes boring into me. Though I kept my eyes down, my ears were fixed on every word he said. She is pure now, Mitchell went on. She is innocent. That is important. Please. I know this must be new to you, but you must try to understand. I quickly glanced toward Mitchell. He was looking straight into the officer's eyes. His voice was calm, tranquil, pleasant. He was pleading in great humility. He was gracious to the core. The officer seemed to be perplexed. Could I convert to your religion just long enough to see her face? No, it is impossible. We've had reports that she might be someone we are looking for. I assure you, sir, she is my daughter. I love her very much. I only want to protect her. I only want to keep her safe and pure. Barzee kept her vice grip upon my thigh, her fingers biting into my flesh. I kept my eyes down, praying the officer would come and rescue me from the hell I had been living every day. Let me ask again. I could convert to your religion. All I want to do is to see her face. I could hear Mitchell move toward me as if he were trying to protect me. Even if you could convert, that wouldn't be enough. Only her family and her husband will ever see her face. And our religion is not something you can convert to in an hour. Our faith takes a lifelong conversion. Every day, we are trying to do better, trying to be more humble and obedient. I am sorry, but your request is impossible. You have to understand we are looking for someone. But officer, if she were the person you were looking for, why would she just sit there? The officer paused. It was an impossible question to answer. I was screaming in my mind. Because I am completely overwhelmed with fear, because I have to protect my family, because I am nothing but an empty shell who can do nothing but what they tell me to. Later, there were times when I was angry with myself for succumbing to that fear, but those with shattered souls find it very difficult to speak. They talked for maybe 15 minutes. To me, it seemed like 15 years. The detective asked a few more questions about who we were and what we believed in. Mitchell answered without any hesitation. He was a wonderful missionary to his own religion when he wanted to be. If he was hiding something, he certainly didn't show it. He was open and sincere and appeared to be without guile. I couldn't believe it. This was the man who raped me every day. The man who stole me from my bedroom. The man who constantly threatened to kill my family. He was as evil and cold-hearted as any man in the world. Now he appeared to be as harmless as a puppy, a simple man who was trying to live his religion in a threatening and judgmental world. Eventually, the officer ran out of questions. He hesitated a long moment. It seemed he was unsure. Then he turned around and walked away, leaving me with the two monsters who had ripped my life apart. As I watched him go down the stairs, every ray of hope that I had ever felt was instantly wiped away. Every ray of hope that I had for my future was swallowed up by an opaque blackness. I couldn't move. I felt I couldn't breathe. I felt as if every last shred of light had been sucked from my world. Mitchell stuffed the map of San Diego into one of his terrible green bags, placed the other maps back on the shelf, then rushed us from the library, holding me with a steel grip. If the officer had stayed around to watch us leave the building, he would have known. If he had seen the way Mitchell jerked me along, treating me like a slave and not a daughter, it would have been obvious. But he was gone. I was alone. We walked back to camp without stopping to rest. All the way, Mitchell never stopped talking, his voice oozing with pride. "The Lord surely has protected me," he said. He utterly blinded that officer's eyes. I kept my mouth shut and kept on walking. This thin veil was all it took to hide my Esther. He laughed, flicking the veil before my face. I am so smart. I am so clever. I told the officer that your husband is the only man that will ever see your face. But the funny thing is, it was your husband who told him that. The farther away we got from the city, the more confident Mitchell became. I stood face to face with a homicide detective, he sneered. He is trained to look for signs of lying and deception. Yet, he believed everything I told him. He looked into my eyes and I convinced him that you were not who they were looking for. I convinced him of that while you were sitting there. God has provided another miracle. And why did he do it? Because no one else will ever see my Esther's face until the Lord has called Hephzibah and my seven wives to testify unto a wicked world. Then I will call them to repentance, and that day is very near. Then he suddenly fell silent. We walked a few minutes in quiet as he thought. His mood seemed to shift. He was more sullen. He could bask in his own glory only for so long before it hit him. He was a breath away from having lost me. He was a breath away from having been arrested. A breath away from having to spend the rest of his life in prison. The reality seemed to sober him, crushing his mood. What happened in the library had to be a message, he said. Surely the Lord is telling me that the world is not yet ready to receive the light in my Esther's eyes. Nope, we can't take any more chances. We can't do anything so dangerous. He turned and glared at Barzee as if it were somehow her fault. Hephzibah, from now on, you and Esther have to stay in camp. No more going into the city. You have to stay up on the mountain until we move to San Diego. Barzee grunted. She didn't like it, but she knew it had to be that way. At that moment, I didn't care about anything anymore. I felt like I was moving through a blur. Though I was walking through my own neighborhood, I saw none of it anymore. The things that used to make me happy, things that used to give me hope, all of these things were invisible to me now. The streets I used to walk on, cars like my family used to drive, flowers that reminded me of my mom. All of these things seemed to melt from my sight. I no longer kept an eye out for an opportunity to escape. I didn't even think about it anymore. I felt nothing but misery. It was maybe the lowest that I had ever felt. How could the officer have turned around and walked away? How could he not have known that I was the one he was looking for? How could I have been left to live with the devil and hell's mistress? Hiking up the main trail, I felt like a prisoner walking back to her cell. I was in solitary confinement with only my guards for company. And I was innocent. I was innocent! But no one seemed to care. Chapter 26, California Dreaming. After the crisis at the library, Mitchell seemed to hunker down, though his initial reaction had been an explosion of pride in his ability to manipulate law enforcement, as well as the realization that there was a certain sensitivity to people's religious customs that would allow him to hide me in plain sight. The reality quickly set in. He had almost been caught. Like the hit of a drug, the effect of manipulating the officer quickly wore off, leaving him paranoid and all the more anxious to get out of Salt Lake. No more was I allowed to go down with him into the city. Neither was Barzee. She had to stay with me all the time, my personal prison guard. But Mitchell didn't back off on the frequency of his own trips into the city. He still had to plunder and minister for food, and he was working hard. Okay, he was begging hard to get enough money to buy the bus tickets to California. Plus, there was the constant demand for alcohol. A few bags of dope from the generous grocer, pornography, a certain amount of daily needs he had to fulfill. So he'd go down and do his thing, leaving Barzee and me up at the lower camp by ourselves, where we did, well, pretty much nothing. All day. Every day. There just wasn't that much to do when you're confined to a tent and a small clearing in the trees. It was horribly boring. You can't even begin to imagine. We rarely cooked. There was little cleaning. I had read every book they had in camp, and I hated them all. I had read the entire scriptures by now, parts of them many times through, and other than reading, there was nothing else to do. My life pretty much consisted of three things: getting raped, being forced to drink alcohol, and sitting on a bucket in a clearing in the trees. But as horribly boring as it was to be left up in the camp, I was still relieved when Mitchell wasn't there. There was the obvious reason that it meant a few hours when I didn't have to wonder when I was going to be raped. Plus, I was just a little more relaxed when he wasn't around. I didn't have to listen to the sound of his constant preaching, his constant talking about himself, the constant singing of church hymns that once I thought were beautiful, but now hated to hear sung in his voice. And Barzee was a little easier to live with when he wasn't around. She was always irritable and whiny, and as pleasant as a thorn under your fingernail. But she was a tiny bit better when Mitchell wasn't leering at me or pulling me into the tent. But I want to be clear. I never developed any kind of affection for Barzee. She was a monster, and I knew that. She never showed me a single moment of kindness. She never demonstrated a single act of compassion or understanding toward me. If Mitchell was the devil, then she was his sneering sidekick. In some ways, I think that she was even worse. She was a woman. She was a mother. She knew what I was going through. Still, of the two evils, I'd take Barzee over Mitchell any day. And anyone who suggests that I became a victim of Stockholm Syndrome by developing any feelings of sympathy toward my captors simply has no idea what was going on inside my head. I never once, not for a single moment, developed a shred of affection or empathy for either one of them. There was no traumatic bonding, no emotional ties. The only thing there ever was fear. And never anything else. That's the only emotion I ever felt toward them. Sometime during the first week in September, the skies started to grow cloudy. It took a couple hours for the billowing clouds to build, but they did. growing dark and menacing in the west. A cold wind suddenly blew down the canyon, bringing an instant chill. The clouds grew darker as they started to climb the mountain. The sky was shrouded in mist and the wind began to howl. Evening was coming quickly and the shadows were growing thick and full. Then it hit. Flashes of light, deep thunder, the air shattered from its power. A hint of rain, and then the hail. Cold, hard, irregular chunks of ice falling from the sky. We ran into our tent for shelter. It was coming down so hard, I wondered if the hail was going to rip the tent apart. We huddled, the tent bent toward the ground, the hail beating down around us. Once the storm passed, we climbed out of the tent. The mountain was white with a thin layer of hail, and the ground was wet and slippery underneath. And it was cold. It was as if nature had announced the end of summer with a single blow. Mitchell looked at the sky. "We've got to leave for California soon," he said. My heart sank. Crushing weight seemed to settle on my shoulders. I had been foolish enough to think that the time to leave for California wouldn't actually come. But it was here now. Soon, we would be gone. San Diego, California, 800 miles from my home. It might as well have been in another universe. I'd be forever lost in California. No one had been able to save me when I was just a few miles from my home. What chance did I have once Mitchell had dragged me off to San Diego? I would lose all hope. It took us a couple of days to get ready. There was a surprising number of things to do. First, we had to decide what we wanted to take with us and organize it for the trip. Everything we were going to take to California had to be packed in Mitchell's nasty green bags, including our bedding, clothing, the tent, the tarps, all of our food, utensils, and his books. It was not an easy thing to do. Then once we had decided what to bring, we hiked back and forth between the upper and lower camps, storing all of the other stuff inside the half-finished dugout, trying to hide it from anyone who might happen upon the camp. We also had to protect it against the animals that would be digging around. Finally, we had to wipe away any of the signs that we had been in the camp. As I watched Mitchell bury the last of our gear deep inside the dugout, I had to wonder, would I ever come back to Salt Lake City? Would he allow us to come back in the spring? Or was he hiding all the gear because he knew he would never be back again? Was he hiding all the gear because he didn't want to leave a trail? Because he knew that he would never need it? Would I ever see these mountains or my hometown again? That afternoon, Barzi and I had our final bath. Mitchell poured bucket after bucket of freezing water over our heads. We washed our grungy robes in the stream, beating them upon the rocks to get them as clean as we could, then headed back to camp. We were working in the tarped area outside the tent when we suddenly heard voices. They were above us, little higher on the mountain, and they were walking toward the bowl that hit our camp. Mitchell froze. Barzi's eyes went as wide as saucers. I didn't know what to do. I was so hopeless at this point, so far removed from thinking that I was ever going to escape, that I didn't even think about calling out. Gathering his wits about him, Mitchell herded us into the tent, hissing at me to be quiet, then scrambled in behind us. He quickly jammed the zipper up, then released a corner of the flap that covered the screen and peered out from the sliver of an opening between the fabric. Whoever was out there was close enough that we could now understand what they were saying. Two men. Apparently they were college students because they were talking about a test they had just taken. It sounded like they were out looking for some kind of animal bones to take back to the lab. They got closer, breaking from the trees where they could see into the bowl that hid our camp. Mitchell glared at me. I sat without emotion in the corner of the tent. Mitchell threw my headdress onto my lap, and I reluctantly put it on. Barzi reached over and secured the veil in front of my face. Mitchell moved to the other side of the tent so he could see them through another slit in the fabric. I crouched and tried to follow him, hoping I could steal a peek, but he pushed me back, almost throwing me to the ground. "Shut up!" he hissed, as though I had said anything. I crouched in the corner and listened intently. The voices suddenly stopped. They must have seen our camp. There was silence for a moment.
"Hello? Is anyone home?"
one of them called out. Mitchell glared at me. Barzee moved a little closer.
Mitchell pressed his thumb and index finger together, then drew them across an imaginary blade as if he were testing that it was sharp. I lowered my eyes and listened, but didn't move. "Hey there! Anyone home?"
one of the young men called out again. Mitchell peered through the slit in the tent, tense as wire, his mind seemingly planning his attack if they were to come into the camp. The air was calm, not a sound. The young men started to walk toward the tent and then stopped.
"Anyone home?" one of them tried a final time.
No answer, only silence.
I could imagine what the students were thinking. They must have felt like they were intruders, like they were trespassing on private property. The camp was well organized and well supplied. It had an air of permanence, like it was someone's home, not just an overnight camping location. If anyone was in the camp, they were obviously hiding in the tent. Clearly, they could hear them, but they were not willing to answer. Not a particularly friendly thing to do. And the camp was hidden in the trees, a long way off the trail. Clearly, whoever lived in the camp had come there with the intention of getting away from people. Nothing indicated that they wanted to be disturbed. Considering all of this, the young men did the right thing. Without saying any more, they turned and walked away. It was the smart thing to do. We waited a long time inside the tent, listening for the sound of voices or footsteps on the dry leaves. Convinced they were gone, Mitchell carefully unzipped the door and climbed out. Barzee and I followed. Mitchell stared at where the young men had been standing. No one was in sight. He waited another minute in silence. I carefully removed my veil.
"That was our sign," Mitchell announced. "The date that I have chosen is acceptable to the Lord. It is time for us to go."
2 days later, Mitchell had us up before dawn. We hiked down the trail in the darkness. All of us had to help carry the green bags, for they were bursting with supplies. In addition, Mitchell had added a small supply of crackers, a bit of cheese, some water, a couple of plates, and a few utensils. "Is this the last time I will ever walk this canyon?" I wondered as we stumbled in the dark. Exiting the trail, we caught the University of Utah shuttle down to Rice-Eccles Stadium and walked downtown to the bus depot. Halfway to the bus stop, I was already very tired, and I felt ridiculous. Not only did I have a sheet across my face, but Mitchell had ordered Barzee to sew a thin veil in front of my eyes, leaving my face completely covered. I could see through the thin material, but only barely, and I felt claustrophobic, peering through the veil. It took us until mid-morning to make it to the bus stop. We entered, and I moved toward a small bench along the far wall. Mitchell commanded us to stay there while he went to buy our tickets. The bus terminal was crowded, with all sorts of people, young and old, all sorts of nationalities. Most of them, no, all of them, were poor. Middle class and rich Americans don't ride the Greyhound bus anymore. Mitchell stood in line at the ticket window. Barzee didn't pay him any attention. She had been ambivalent about the move to California, and I think she was already tired of the work. Being out in public changed her relationship with me. Up on the mountain, I was her slave. She could boss me around, make me haul the water, cook, do most of the work. But she had to pitch in to help now, and that bothered her a lot. Her body language was unmistakable. She simmered. Was it really appropriate for the future mother of Zion to be hauling packs around? While she seethed, I had time to look for any friendly faces in the crowd. When someone caught my attention, I tried to stare at them, hoping I could communicate with just my eyes, even through the thin veil. I was still praying for someone to rescue me, for someone to recognize me and whisk me away. A middle-aged black woman seemed to look at me. I thought I caught a hint of a smile. Maybe she's a mother. Maybe she understands what trouble looks like. Maybe
She will see the desperation in my eyes.
I stared at her, praying she would recognize me.
Glancing at me, she got a sour look on her face.
What are you staring at? She sneered.
Don't you know that's rude? And why don't you take that rag off your face?
I looked away. I felt ashamed. I felt rejected. I felt my hopes were being shattered once again. It was the last time that I ever tried to communicate with someone through my veil.
Mitchell came back to us with the bus tickets. He was so proud. His ministering had paid our way to California. The Lord had provided once again. A few minutes later, we started boarding. There were only two seats on each side of the bus, and Mitchell pushed me toward a window seat, then dropped into the seat beside me. Farzi sat in front of us with the green bag that held our meager supply of food. Mitchell didn't even wait until the bus pulled out of the depot before he reached up and took some of the food out of the bag and started stuffing his mouth with crackers and cheese. I was worried. No, it was more than that. I was terrified. I had already felt real hunger, and I didn't want to feel it again. And at the rate Mitchell was eating, our food would be gone before we even made it to Nevada. What would we do then? It had taken almost every penny that we had to buy the bus tickets to California. We were leaving the generous grocer behind. We were leaving behind all of Mitchell's friends. Mitchell didn't know a soul in San Diego. Where were we going to stay? How were we going to live? How would we get more food? Mitchell must have been in an especially good mood that we were finally getting out of Salt Lake City because he passed me a few crackers and some cheese. Maybe it would be better if we didn't eat right now, I said. Maybe we should save it until we really need it. Mitchell and Barzi acted like I wasn't there. I thought about trying to save some of the food, but changed my mind. Better to eat some while I could. The bus was crowded. I thought it smelled bad, but maybe that was just Mitchell. The bus pulled out of the station, black smoke belching from the exhaust pipes underneath us. We rode south through Salt Lake City and then Provo, 70 miles of nothing but cities and bedroom suburbs. On the other side of Provo, we started to hit the rural counties, where there were miles and miles of nothing but sagebrush, juniper-covered mountains, and barren desert. Every passing mile took me farther and farther from my home, farther from my family, farther from the people I loved. We continued through central and southern Utah, the great rock country outside of Zion National Park. We stopped in some of the larger towns. A few people got off, a few people got on. The ride seemed to take forever. The bus driver was a pleasant woman who would jump on the intercom from time to time to tell us bus jokes. I almost smiled. I didn't know there was such a thing as bus jokes. We passed over the Utah border. Will I ever be home again? I wondered. It was starting to get dark. We rode through a few miles of Arizona before the freeway turned west and dropped into Nevada. I leaned against the window and watched the passing terrain. Not much to look at. Nothing happening out there. In the middle of the night, we stopped in Las Vegas to change buses. A lot more people got off the bus than got on. For the rest of the ride to California, I had a row to myself. I know it wasn't much, but I was grateful for the space. Mitchell, always a very light sleeper, seemed to jerk and wake up every time I even moved. No way he was going to let me slip off the bus in the middle of the night. We finally made it to San Diego. It was still dark, but the eastern sky was turning a shade of gray. We stepped off the bus into a thick mist. I looked down the street. The roads were shrouded in heavy fog. Every streetlight formed a perfect circle in the yellow light, each one a little smaller the farther they were from me. I began to shiver. It was so clammy, so unfriendly and depressing. Mitchell studied the metro map on the wall outside the bus stop, then pulled out the map he'd stolen from the library, his eyes moving back and forth. Finally, he turned to us and said, "Lakeside is where we will go."